KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
It wasn't until this flight was already in international waters, heading down to El Salvador, that the judge made some comment about returning the flights.
Did the Trump administration violate a court order by deporting alleged gang members from Venezuela?
Today is Monday, March 17th, and this is All Things Considered.
I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. American political scholars are seeing parallels between the U.S. and China.
When you talk about make America great again, this is very similar to the view of Xi, who sees a much more expansionary, important role for China in Asia.
Also, Ukrainians are rallying around their president after the way he was treated by President Trump at the White House.
On my Facebook account, many people that I know hate Zelensky. They were actually supporting him.
And how to stay safe as the measles continues to spread in parts of the U.S.
Those stories and more after this summary of the day's news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. A federal judge today chastised the Department of Justice for defying multiple rulings ordering that flights carrying some alleged members of a Venezuelan gang turned around Saturday. NPR's Sergio Martinez Beltran reports on today's hearings.
The Trump administration has until midday Tuesday to explain why it did not comply with the judge's oral and written orders to stop using the Alien Enemies Act to remove migrants to El Salvador. The White House says they include suspected members of Tren de Aragua, which the U.S. recently designated a foreign terror group. The Justice Department argued that an oral ruling was not enough to stop them, but that they did not fly any more migrants once the written order was released. Judge James Boasberg called that, quote, a heck of a stretch. The hearing raised multiple questions, including about the weight of an oral order compared to a written one. According to the White House, 261 people were removed to El Salvador, but only 137 of them were expelled under Trump's wartime power at the core of the case. Sergio Martinez Beltran, NPR News.
The U.S. Institute of Peace is the scene of a hostile takeover this evening by the Trump administration's government efficiency group, DOGE. They forced their way into the building with the help of D.C. police, as we hear from NPR's Michelle Kellerman.
In a brief statement, USIP Acting President George Moose writes, quote, DOGE has broken into our building. They came with someone that the Trump administration has tried to put in charge. An attorney for USIP, George Foote, has been fighting this in court.
We're very confident that what's happened here under the guise of a change of control is wrong and will be upheld in court. But we were having civil discussions about that, and then suddenly muscle arrives with guns and we're kicked out of the building.
The U.S. Institute of Peace is a think tank funded by Congress. It is not a government agency, and the president can only fire board members for cause. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, the State Department.
The Trump administration wants to make it easier to build affordable housing on federally owned lands. NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports the push will be led by the Department of Housing and Interior.
The housing agency HUD says it will identify where the need for housing is greatest and work with local and state governments. The Interior Department will identify underused federal land suitable for residential living. A joint task force will work to streamline the red tape that comes with transferring or leasing public land. The U.S. government owns more than 600 million acres, and it's a big part of several western states. But nationally, the housing shortage is most severe in major cities with far less federal land. Local opposition and labor shortages are persistent challenges for affordable housing, and tariffs are expected to drive construction costs higher. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow rose 353 points. The Nasdaq was up 54 points today. This is NPR. Closing arguments are slated to get underway in a lawsuit filed by a pipeline company against the environmental firm Greenpeace. Greenpeace says the case could have consequences for speech and protest rights. Dallas-based Energy Transfer and its subsidiary Dakota Access allege defamation, trespass, nuisance, and other offenses by Netherlands-based Greenpeace International and its American branch. The pipeline company is seeking hundreds of millions of dollars. Officials from the Democratic Republic of Congo will hold peace talks with Rwandan-backed rebels that have launched a major offensive. More from NPR's Emmanuel Akinwudu.
The M23 rebels said they will send a delegation to peace talks with the DRC in the Angolan capital, Luanda. DRC's President Felix Tshisekedi had long vowed not to negotiate with the group, which has occupied major cities in eastern DRC near the border with Rwanda. but the group's advance since January has fueled criticism of the government and spread fears of a potential coup in the DRC. Now the negotiations are set to begin. Rwanda denies backing the M23, a Tutsi-led rebel group, but the UN and countries like the US. But the UN and other countries, including the US, have accused Rwanda of arming M23 and using them to exploit DRC's mineral resources. Emmanuel Akinwotu, NPR News, Lagos.
Since entirely remaking the board at the Kennedy Center for Performing Arts and making himself the chairman, President Trump visited the facility today. Trump toured the Kennedy Center, then chaired a meeting of the center's board. Trump fired a number of members of the previous board, replacing them with loyalists. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include CFP, Certified Financial Planner Professionals, committed to acting in their clients' best interests. Learn more at letsmakeaplan.org. And the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. This evening, a federal judge chastised the Trump administration for not answering basic questions about deportation flights that took place this weekend and that may have violated his court order. On Saturday, the Trump administration invoked a rarely used wartime law from 1798 to rapidly remove a group of migrants, most of them Venezuelans, and many of them alleged gang members. Despite an order from a federal judge demanding that the flights not take off or that they turn back, more than 200 migrants were sent to a prison in El Salvador, more than half of them under what's called the Alien Enemies Act. Joining us now with the latest is NPR's Jasmine Garst. Hi, Jasmine.
Hi.
Okay, so what happened tonight when this federal judge, Judge James Boasberg, asked the government to explain these deportation flights?
Okay, so over the weekend, the first order Judge Boasberg issued was to stop the deportations and turn around any planes. And that order was oral. It was not written. Now, this is important because today the Justice Department lawyer, Abhishek Kambli, argued that the government took into consideration the later written ruling. Now, the judge pushed back and asked if the order was disregarded simply because it was verbal, saying, quote, "That's a heck of a stretch." Secondly, the lawyer for the Justice Department said that by the time the oral ruling came down, some of the planes were already outside U.S. airspace, and that the president, as commander-in-chief, has broad authority over foreign relations. Now, the judge seemed pretty skeptical about that as well. Finally, several questions were asked about who was on the planes, how many passengers on each plane, and at what time the planes departed, landed, and when were the passengers transferred to El Salvador's infamous prison. But the Justice Department refused repeatedly to answer, citing national security and foreign policy concerns.
And then I know that Judge Boasberg said that he expects the government to come back to court by noon tomorrow with answers, right? Like, what exactly is the judge asking for tomorrow?
The judge chastised the DOJ lawyer for not being prepared and said by noon tomorrow he wants to know at what time those planes carrying deportees to El Salvador left the U.S. He also wants to know if this is, as the lawyer argued, classified information. He needs to know why. Why can't he at least be told in a closed session? Now, the judge ended by saying, "I'll be sure to put all this in a written order, since my oral orders don't seem to carry any weight."
Okay, well, Jazz, can we just step back and can you remind us, like, what is the Alien Enemies Act, this law that President Trump invoked.
So the Alien Enemies Act gives the president sweeping wartime powers to deport non-citizens without giving them a chance to go in front of a judge and plead their case. It was invoked last during World War II, and it was used to round up Japanese, German, and Italian citizens in the U.S. without due process.
So what's the administration's rationale for invoking this very old wartime law right now?
Well, the Trump administration recently designated the Venezuelan gang Tren de Aragua as a foreign terrorist organization. And when they invoked the Alien Enemies Act, they stated that many of these gang members are, quote, conducting irregular warfare and undertaking hostile actions. But critics say this is the president overstepping his bounds, and it could lead to a constitutional crisis.
That is NPR's Jasmine Garz. Thank you so much, Jasmine.
Thank you.
People are just beginning to clean up after severe storms swept across the country this weekend. In Missouri, Mississippi, and Arkansas, tornadoes killed dozens of people, wrecked hundreds of homes. NPR's Frank Morris traveled to Wayne County, a rural part of Missouri, where six people died.
People are spread thin in Wayne County. 11,000 live into small towns and enclaves tucked into valleys. Just after sunup this morning, Sheriff Kyle Shearer pulled into a riverside lane full of tree limbs and twisted, splintered wrecks where people used to live. He wasn't expecting this.
I mean, I was out on my porch watching it, because it's almost like a normal storm. You know, you get so many warnings, nothing ever happens. And this time it happened. You know, everything's on the ground. It's just flattened, and it's just debris everywhere, trees everywhere. It's devastating.
Three people just across the river from here died in the storm, two in a house and one camping. 15 miles away, another twister chewed up and spit out a group of homes near Des Arc, Missouri. Casey Melton is picking through two houses. One stood for 50 years before the tornado swept it up and spit it across this valley.
Well, this is my grandfather's house here, and mine's the one that's still halfway standing over there farther. Devastating. I mean, we see this on TV, you know, but you hate to see it there, and you really hate to see it in person.
Melton, his family, and his grandfather managed to get out to shelter. Others weren't so fortunate. Three people died here.
These two over here were in their home. They believed they were asleep. They found them out in their pajamas in the yard. Lifelong residents here. Good neighbors.
Melton's planning to rebuild, but it's going to take time. This jumbled mess, even replacing the mangled power lines, is a challenge for repair crews.
Their poles, a lot of them, they can't even find where they went, how they went through here. They were kind of relying on the locals to help point them in the right direction because it's unrecognizable.
Getting life back in order will be even harder, especially for the families of the people who died. Frank Morris, NPR News, Leeper, Missouri.
American political scientists and historians who study China say they see more parallels today between their area of study, Chinese politics, and their own country, the United States, than ever before. NPR's Emily Fang spent the last decade covering China and has this story.
David Lampton is a political science professor at Johns Hopkins University on the Washington, D.C. campus. Lampton also lived in China during what was called the Cultural Revolution, a decade-long mass movement ending in the 1970s to purge what the then chairman, Mao Zedong, believed were deep state elements conspiring against the communist cause and his hold on power.
There are echoes of kind of cultural revolution politics in American politics today.
Specifically,
the attempt to control media, to build a cult of personality, all has differences between now here in the U.S. and there, but there are also some, let's say, eerie echoes.
Echoes, like how the Trump administration has banned the AP's access to certain media events in the Oval Office or onboard Air Force One. Here's Trump.
Now, the Associated Press, as you know, has been very, very wrong on the election, on Trump, and the treatment of Trump.
Lampton is among the China watchers who have spent most of their adult lives studying China and who now find themselves using their expertise to understand American politics. They stress the U.S. is a democracy with functioning courts to balance the executive branch. And China is a one-party system, so they are not identical. But these China watchers do feel uneasy at the parallels they are seeing. Orville Schell is director of the Center on U.S.-China Relations at the Asia Society in New York, and he also sees similarities between Trump and his downsizing of the federal government and Mao Zedong.
Both of these men are deeply in love with the idea that you can't be creative unless you first destroy.
Mao purged bureaucrats, citing disloyalty and alleged dissent. President Trump has vowed the same.
Because we are draining the swamp. It's very simple. And the days of rule by unelected bureaucrats are over.
Schell says Mao was constantly suspicious of other party officials, hence multiple purges.
Here, both men, I think, shared a kind of common sense of paranoia that the existing order is fundamentally hostile to him and needs to be overturned.
Other China experts like Yukon Huang at the Washington think tank Carnegie Endowment for International Peace compare Trump's global outlook to another Chinese leader, the current one, Xi Jinping.
When you talk about make America great again, this is very similar to the view of Xi, who sees a much more expansionary, important role for China in Asia.
As in China's aggressive ramp up of its military and economic influence in the Asia Pacific and Africa is comparable to Trump's more muscular foreign policy, threatening to take the Panama Canal and expressing desire to control Greenland and Canada, all the while stressing American interests first. One of Xi Jinping's key slogans is this, the China Dream, for what he calls here on the Chinese Communist paper, The People's Daily, the great rejuvenation of the Chinese nation.
Things like MAGA, just like, a China dream.
This is Wu Guoguang, a former advisor to a reformist Chinese leader. Wu moved to the U.S. in the 1990s and is now a political science researcher at Stanford University, studying how leaders like China's Xi Jinping use policy to concentrate power. He says American democracy does have ways to stop this kind of concentration.
Checks and balances. And public opinion, civil society.
But absent mass demonstrations, Wu says he's increasingly pessimistic those checks and balances are working well enough. NPR reached out to two China experts who worked for the Trump administration during the first term. They declined to be interviewed. And Wu was not alone. Last month, more than 1,200 American political scientists signed a letter protesting what they see as the undermining of checks and balances in the U.S. system by the Trump administration. Emily Fang, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Bank of America. From local shops to global enterprises, Bank of America is committed to helping businesses of all sizes make every move matter. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Measles continues to spread in West Texas and New Mexico. About 300 cases have been reported since the outbreak began in January. But the actual number of infections is likely higher. At the same time, some isolated measles cases have been reported in a dozen other states, largely linked to international travel. Joining us now to talk about all things measles is NPR's Maria Godoy. Hi, Maria.
Hi, Elsa.
Okay, so let's talk about the difference between these isolated cases I just mentioned and the Texas outbreak. What's going on there?
Okay, well, so the U.S. declared measles eliminated in 2000, and that just means there's not ongoing transmission for greater than 12 months in an area. But the U.S. has reported measles cases every year. It's usually unvaccinated people, you know, who are bringing measles back from traveling abroad. We see these all the time. We've seen that this year in Alaska and Maryland, where I live. Mm-hmm. An outbreak is different. It's when the virus is spreading locally. And right now, the virus is spreading in remote areas of West Texas and New Mexico. The concern is that you might have someone who is sick and then they travel to another area where vaccination rates are low and they could potentially seed another outbreak there.
Okay. And at that point, how do you stop that from happening?
Vaccination. So measles is the most contagious infectious disease known to man. It's more contagious than Ebola, than polio, than chickenpox. It's so contagious that in a world where no one's vaccinated, one person sick with measles could go on to infect 18 others on average. Wow. You know, and it's airborne, which means, it, you know, these infectious particles can linger in the air for up to 2 hours. So if you have a sick person walk into a room, cough, leave, and then an hour later someone comes in, they could potentially get infected and pass it on to others. The other thing is you're infectious from about 4 days before you develop that telltale red measles rash until 4 days after. So that's, you know, 8 days really where you could be spreading it to others. Now, the good news is the measles vaccine is very safe and highly effective. Two doses of the vaccine is 97% effective, which, yeah, and you need high vaccination rates in a community so that there's no one vulnerable to measles. And so the virus has really nowhere to go and spread.
I had no idea measles lingers in the air for 2 hours. Wow. Okay. How is the federal government right now responding to this outbreak?
It depends on which part of the federal government you're talking about. So the CDC has issued a measles alert and, you know, asked doctors to be on the lookout for people with fevers and the red rashes. It's sent vaccines to Texas, and it says unequivocally vaccination is the best defense against measles. But when it comes to Robert F. Kennedy Jr., the Health and Human Services Secretary, he wrote an editorial piece for Fox, and he's been on Fox in an interview. He has said vaccines protect individuals from measles and, you know, they contribute to community immunity. But he's also called vaccination a personal choice, and he didn't outright urge people to get vaccinated. The other thing he said was that good nutrition is a best defense against chronic and infectious diseases, which, again, the public health line has long been that when it comes to measles, vaccination is absolutely the best defense.
Yeah. Okay, well, another claim that we're hearing is that the vaccine is more dangerous than the measles virus. What are doctors saying about that?
That's absolutely false. The vaccine is very safe and highly effective. Again, two doses, 97% effective. Meanwhile, measles is still a dangerous virus. It can kill, you know, before we had vaccines, 400 to 500 kids used to die in the U.S. each year from measles. And it can cause blindness, deafness, brain swelling. The virus can also have long-term effects. So after measles infection, to some extent, your immune system's memory can be erased, which means that pathogens your body used to know how to defeat, it no longer remembers how to defeat them. So you're not immune anymore. And this effect can last 2 to 3 years. I know, it's called immune amnesia. And, you know, it can even cause neurological problems years after infection.
Well, yeah. Given these potentially very, very serious consequences from measles, how worried should people be right now in light of this current outbreak?
I want to stress that there's no reason to panic right now. Vaccination rates are still high enough nationwide in most places to stop a major outbreak from happening. But if vaccination rates continue to fall as they have been over the last several years, you know, in 5 to 10 years, experts I spoke with say we might go back to the days when we had measles outbreaks with thousands of cases and, you know, many deaths.
Well, how can people better protect themselves right now?
Get vaccinated if you're not already. Make sure you've had 2 shots of the measles vaccine. And, you know, get your kids vaccinated too. Parents can talk to their pediatricians about getting younger kids vaccinated early if they're traveling abroad or are in an outbreak area. In fact, the CDC says anybody traveling abroad with an infant 6 months or older should, you know, get them vaccinated early. It's usually more about 12 months. That's a schedule. If you're not sure about your own vaccination status and you can't check your immunization records, there's no harm in getting another dose.
Okay, let's just say you do the right thing, you get vaccinated. Like, I was vaccinated as a kid, and I think I even got the booster. What are the chances that you could get the measles even though you're vaccinated?
They're really, really low. So no vaccine is 100% effective, but measles is pretty darn high, 97% effective. And you know what? The more people in a community are vaccinated, the more effective the vaccine is for everyone.
Absolutely. That is NPR's Maria Godoy. Thank you so much, Maria.
My pleasure.
Trump administration officials say it was only, quote, common sense security to prevent a Rhode Island doctor from returning to the U.S. from her native Lebanon. As NPR's Tovia Smith reports, officials say she was found with what they call extremist materials linked to a U.S. designated terrorist group.
Dr. Rasha Alloway, a kidney transplant specialist at a medical center affiliated with Brown University, was in the U.S. on an H-1B visa when she went to visit Lebanon and got stopped at Boston's Logan Airport trying to return. A Department of Homeland Security spokesperson, Tricia McLaughlin, says immigration officers found evidence that Alloway went to the funeral of Hassan Nasrallah, the leader of Hezbollah, which is a U.S.-designated terrorist group, and that she supports him. Court documents cited by multiple news outlets describe photos and videos of the funeral on her phone in the deleted items folder. McLaughlin called Nasrallah, quote, a brutal terrorist responsible for killing hundreds of Americans, and she said glorifying and supporting such terrorists is grounds for denying a visa. Alloway's lawyer, Stephanie Marzouk, declined to comment on those specific allegations, but she says Alloway should not have been sent back to Lebanon and denied due process.
We're not going to stop fighting to get her back in the U.S. to see her patients where she should be, and we're going to try to make sure the government follows the rule of law.
Marzouk says they tried to stop Alloway's plane from leaving up to the very last minute, but were basically stonewalled by administration officials, even though they had a court order saying Alloway could not be deported without advance notice. Government attorneys deny any wrongdoing. Meantime, several colleagues and acquaintances showed up at court in Boston this morning to show their support for Alloway, including Kathleen Henderson.
I think she's being treated terribly, and I think she has rights. She was here legally. She had a visa when she returned. They are harassing her.
A federal judge had scheduled a hearing to consider whether immigration officials willfully disobeyed his order, but he canceled it after one of Alloway's attorneys abruptly quit the case and a new one wanted time to catch up. Plus, the judge said Alloway was already gone, so it was no longer urgent. Tovia Smith, NPR News, Boston.
This is NPR News.
For many of us, the start of spring means the start of gardening season, and who better than Martha Stewart to guide us through the planting process?
The garden can evolve, and I love that about gardening.
The icon of domesticity joins us to discuss all the best tips in her new gardening handbook. That conversation on the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Abel Rivera lost his home in the L.A. fires along with a beloved marathon medal.
Yesterday, he ran the L.A. Marathon and got a second medal.
It feels like a milestone. And running the marathon is nostalgic. It reminds me of times before I had the fire.
Now news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Duane Brown. President Trump toured the Kennedy Center in Washington, D.C. this afternoon after a recent shakeup in leadership. Trump also presided over a board meeting as the new chair of the Performing Arts Center. NPR's Isabella Gomez-Sarmiento has more.
During his visit to the Kennedy Center in Washington, D.C., President Trump criticized the cultural center as being in, quote, tremendous disrepair.
I'm so surprised because, you know, I know the person who was in charge of it, and he's a good man. I never realized this was in such bad shape. I've been so busy, I haven't been able to be here in a long time.
David Rubenstein was the longtime chair of the Kennedy Center until last month, when he, the Board of Trustees, and Kennedy Center President Deborah Rutter were ousted. President Trump appointed a new board, which elected him chair of the Kennedy Center. He has accused the Arts Center of being too woke and vows that under his leadership, that will change. Isabella Gomez-Sarmiento, NPR News.
German authorities are now monitoring the treatment of its citizens traveling to the U.S. after the recent detention of several Germans on entry into the country. As Esme Nicholson tells us, German tourists and a German green card holder have been detained.
Germany's foreign ministry says it's consulting partners within the European Union to determine whether the recent detention and deportation of German citizens represents a change in U.S. immigration policy or whether these are isolated cases. The foreign ministry in Berlin confirmed that it is aware of three cases in which German citizens have recently been barred from entering the U.S. and detained in deportation centers. Last week, a 29-year-old woman from Berlin returned to Germany after being held for weeks in detention in California. She alleges being held in solitary confinement for 8 days. For NPR News, I'm Esme Nicholson in Berlin.
This is NPR. The State Emergency Operations Center in Oklahoma responded to 130 fires last week, fanned by strong winds and extremely dry conditions. At least 4 people died. From member station KOSU, Grayson Wheeler has more on recovery efforts.
Oklahomans are still working to get a handle on how much they lost, as official damage assessments began today. Preliminary numbers show hundreds of buildings were destroyed. Local churches, casinos, and community centers have opened their doors to feed and house people who lost their homes or found themselves otherwise displaced. As Oklahomans deal with the fallout from the infernos, fire crews are preparing for the possibility of more. That's because critical fire weather is ramping up again. An Oklahoma Forestry Service spokesperson says today could be bad and Tuesday will likely be worse. For NPR News, I'm Grayson Wheeler in Oklahoma City.
St. Patrick's Day celebrations in the Irish capital of Dublin are culminating with a 3-day festival and parade, while New York City held one of the largest and oldest parades here in the U.S. down Fifth Avenue today with about 150,000 participants. The annual commemoration of Ireland's patron saint has also become a major celebration of Irish heritage around the world. Stocks finished modestly higher ahead of this week's Federal Reserve meeting on interest rates. You're listening to NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station And from Raymond James, a firm focused on transforming lives, businesses, and communities through tailored wealth management, banking, and capital market solutions. Disclosures at RaymondJames.com. From Indiana University, establishing the IU Launch Accelerator for Biosciences to drive healthcare discoveries and train the next generation of innovators. More at go.iu.edu/iulab. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington. President Trump will speak with Russian President Vladimir Putin on Tuesday to see if Russia will also agree to the 30-day ceasefire that Ukraine agreed to last week. Now, most Ukrainians do not believe Putin will negotiate in good faith, and many now also wonder if the U.S. can be counted on after the way Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky was treated by Trump and Vice President J.D. Vance last month in the Oval Office. Ukrainians are rallying around their leader and finding dark humor in the uncertainty, as NPR's Eleanor Beardsley reports from Kyiv.
When Ukrainians saw their president berated in the White House last month, it gave him a shot in the political arm back home, says Anton Grushetsky, director of the Kyiv International Institute of Sociology, which measures public opinion. He says Zelensky's approval rating jumped 10% and is now pushing 70.
We need to understand that people perceived all these attacks not as attacks on solely Zelensky, but as attacks on the whole Ukraine and all Ukrainians. So people are furious, and actually more people are united around the president.
Kyiv resident Mikhail Smetana says he's certainly noticed that. We meet at an outdoor food market in the city.
On my Facebook account, many people that I know hate Zelensky, but they were actually supporting him.
But as usual, it doesn't take Ukrainians long to find comedy amidst the tragedy, with memes and jokes going viral. One Ukrainian TikTok star played his guitar to a little ditty he composed about the Oval Office spat. Because this is how Ukrainians cope, says Smetana.
We make jokes of everything, and that helps us surviving. The whole war, we survive on memes.
One aspect of Zelensky's White House dressing down has gotten a lot of mockery. When Vice President J.D. Vance accused him of not being grateful enough.
Thank you for your support, every American citizen.
This Instagram reel strings together examples of Zelensky's effusive public gratitude to America, some 94 instances since the full-scale invasion, according to the video. Another meme shows some of the other leaders who've shown up at the White House not wearing suits. There's Winston Churchill, Narendra Modi, and of course Elon Musk, who even keeps his baseball cap on inside the Oval Office.
Humor is a very important psychological mechanism to cope with the situation.
But, says sociologist Grushetsky, the humor also masks the hurt and anxiety Ukrainians feel on possibly being abandoned by their most important ally. In a Kyiv coffee shop, student Yulia Mala says there's a perception here that the Trump administration is suddenly treating Russia like a good faith partner, and that's distressing.
We want to say it very clear that Russia, it's not like some good guys and we could talk. They killed our people and they keep in doing it, and we want to say it clear that this is enemy.
I meet 34-year-old Taras strolling in a Kyiv park. While he doesn't want to give his last name, he says it's unnerving to hear President Trump parroting what he calls Kremlin propaganda, that Ukraine needs to hold elections.
Those who demand elections are completely ignorant about the security situation. Just imagine how many Ukrainians are refugees in foreign countries, how many Ukrainians are displaced, how many Ukrainians are currently on the front line.
How could you possibly find and get ballots to everyone, he asks. And as for security, forget it. Polling stations would make perfect targets for Russian ballistic missiles. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Kyiv.
In California, Democrats' grip on the state legislature took a slight hit last November when Republicans gained a handful of seats amid rising concerns about the cost of living. Now, Democrats in Sacramento say reducing costs is their top priority. But that could force some big changes in California's nation-leading efforts to fight climate change. From member station KQED, here's Guy Marzorati.
Southern California legislator Jackie Irwin can easily list the ways that the effects of climate change are hitting the state.
Cycles of intense flooding,
historic droughts,
rising seas that threaten our coastlines,
unprecedented heat waves,
and closest to home for me, devastating wildfires.
Those fires, like the ones that tore through Los Angeles earlier this year, are making life more expensive for all Californians.
Whether through rising utility bills,
because power companies are raising prices to update their equipment and limit the risk of starting wildfires. On top of that,
insurance premiums,
which are going up for homeowners to cover the massive losses insurers like State Farm are incurring in these disasters.
Poll after poll has shown this is the number one issue for California voters, the cost of living.
That's James Gallagher, the Republican leader in the state assembly. His party sees an opportunity to use anxiety over costs to chip away at the supermajorities Democrats hold in both houses.
We need to do something. We need to act urgently on this issue, and Republicans are prepared to do so.
But Republicans still have no real leverage at the California Capitol. It's Democrats who are now facing the challenge of weighing affordability against another top party priority, reducing greenhouse gas emissions that are worsening these climate disasters. And that balancing act could result in changes to the state's landmark climate initiative, known as cap and trade. That program is a key way states like California and Washington have come to fight climate change on their own, apart from the federal government. Here's how it works. Cap and trade starts with a goal of reducing greenhouse gas emissions, says Meredith Fowley of the Energy Institute at UC Berkeley.
We set a target. You know, California has some emissions targets that say we want to reduce our emissions by X percent by this date.
That creates a cap, a statewide limit on pollution. Then California requires companies to buy and trade credits that allow them to pollute under the cap, creating a market for carbon.
You can think of a carbon market like an auction.
And those auctions raise a lot of money for California, with around $3 to $4 billion a year flowing into state coffers. Michael Wara, a climate research scholar at Stanford, says right now the state spends most of that money to further reduce carbon emissions.
In California, we invest a lot of money in high-speed rail,
in building housing near train and bus stops,
and in EVs.
But the question in front of lawmakers
is whether that approach is sustainable or whether we need to be thinking about giving money back to people.
That could mean taking some dollars away from transit and housing and instead giving it back to Californians to help pay for the rising cost of things like electricity or gas. Those are the trade-offs facing California lawmakers as they seek to balance global climate leadership with an electorate already feeling the costs of a warming planet. For NPR News, I'm Guy Marzorati in San Jose.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. It's St. Patrick's Day, a day to celebrate everything Irish. The Chicago River and the White House Fountain run green. Savannah and New York City host parades. And if you are very lucky, you're snacking right now on soda bread slathered with Irish butter. So, how does one of the most influential Irish musicians in America celebrate today's holiday? NPR's Netta Ulaby brings us this postcard from the founder of the band Cherish the Ladies.
for Joni Madden. It's not St. Patrick's Day so much as St. Patrick's Month.
We're celebrating with 20 gigs this month. We have 11-piece band on the road, including 6 musicians and 4 step dancers.
They all call it, she says, March Madness.
March Madness. I know that's usually a basketball term, but it's our March Madness.
Madden founded her band, Cherish the Ladies, 40 years ago. At the time, professional Irish music was dominated by men. Now, Cherish the Ladies is a Grammy-nominated Celtic supergroup.
And we've performed almost 4,000 concerts all over the world and recorded 18 albums.
In 2021, Madden was named a National Heritage Fellow by the National Endowment for the Arts. When she was growing up, playing Irish music in the Bronx, her flute teacher told her the tin whistle was a toy. But Joni Madden now plays it with the kind of superlative genius that Simone Biles applies to gymnastics.
I just love the feeling I can evoke through that little piece of tin with 6 holes in it. I can really feel my soul coming alive when I'm playing it, and it does something to me.
Madden also composes music. One of her pieces is played now by her band at every concert. It's called Longing for Home.
And I wrote about my parents, who are immigrants that came from Ireland, came here penniless and worked like dogs.
It's an homage, she says, to her ancestors and to every American immigrant.
I played this tune for all the immigrants that came to this country. And for me, I've never met an immigrant that I haven't seen that hasn't worked their behinds off from whatever country they came from. I think immigrant has become a bad word these days. And without the immigrants, this country would be nothing. So everybody from every part of the world helps to make us who we are.
St. Patrick's Day, she says, is an immigrant's holiday. Not just for 30 million Irish Americans, but for Americans, period. And, she adds, this Irish American will be sitting down at the end of March Madness with her band at an Irish pub.
There's some that'll be drinking wine, there'll be some drinking a brandy, there'll be some having a couple of Guinnesses and a couple of Coors Light. We all deserve it because, you know, it's a tough month.
But every month, she says, is a grand one to play Irish music. Netta Ulaby, NPR News.
When tourism took off in Zanzibar in the 1990s, it brought all kinds of opportunity, but also some problems. In his new novel, Theft, Nobel Prize-winning author Abdul Razak Gurna looks at how the influx of new people changed the lives of the locals, including how they saw themselves. That's on the next All Things Considered. If you aren't by the radio, you can ask your smart speaker to play NPR or your local station by name. This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
Thank you.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Bans on diversity, equity, inclusion, and accessibility. Closures of federal civil rights offices. Stopping the collection of data about diversity and discrimination. Civil rights lawyers and scholars say that these things are part of a push to dismantle and even to end civil rights in America. NPR's Sandhya Dirks reports.
For a while now, Victor Ray, a professor at the University of Iowa, has felt almost afraid to say what he's been thinking out loud.
Because when you say that people on the right are attempting to overturn the civil rights movement, you sound kind of unhinged.
The idea that civil rights has gone too far has been getting more explicit on the right. Charlie Kirk is a far-right influencer with close ties to President Trump's family and his campaign. On his talk show a year ago, he spoke with Jeremy Carl of the Claremont Institute, an anti-diversity think tank with ties to the far right.
The Civil Rights Act, though, let's be clear, created a beast, and that beast has now turned into an anti-white weapon.
Yeah. And that's the reality. And so we just need to fundamentally relook at a lot of our civil rights legal regime. And without
one of the great victories of the civil rights movement happened just over 60 years ago when President Lyndon Baines Johnson spoke to Americans from their grainy black and white TV sets.
I'm about to sign into law the Civil Rights Act of 1964.
That act did not end racism. But it made segregation in businesses, in public places, in schools, illegal.
My fellow citizens, we have come now to a time of testing. We must not fail.
Professor Ray says while things got better, the U.S. never really passed all the tests. Many schools remained segregated, unequal outcomes continued, and other civil rights laws, like the Voting Rights Act, have been chipped away at. But he says at least there was some imperfect mechanism in place to enforce civil rights law and monitor the realities of racism. Now he says the federal government is dismantling all that.
Threatening universities that have anti-discrimination policies with loss of funding, calling classes like the kind I teach about America's history of racial inequality, discrimination against white students.
Maya Wiley, president of the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights, which worked in the 50s and 60s to get civil rights legislation passed, says it also means rebranding civil rights, rebranding it to focus on what groups like the conservative think tank, the Heritage Foundation's Project 2025 calls anti-white racism.
It says we want to flip the script. And the script means the interpretation of our laws to say white men have been abused by civil rights.
Wiley says Project 2025's plan calls for disabling the regulatory apparatus of civil rights laws and putting a stop to the collection of data that measures racism, sexism, and other bigotry. Right-wing activist Christopher Rufo is a key storyteller of a narrative that claims anti-white racism is rampant. Here's Rufo on the New York Times Matter of Opinion podcast earlier this month, talking about the two strains of conservative arguments about civil rights.
The argument would be that the Civil Rights Act is a fundamental infringement on civil liberties and freedom of association, freedom of speech, and therefore it, you know, requires abolition.
Rufo acknowledges abolishing civil rights is probably not going to happen. Instead, he favors this plan.
The right needs to have its own interpretation of civil rights law.
He says that means what he calls colorblind enforcement, prioritizing anti-white racism as much as anti-black racism. Jamelia Morgan, director of the Center for Racial and Disability Justice at Northwestern University, says that actually means a co-option of civil rights that requires erasing the reality of discrimination today and yesterday.
If you can't tell the history, it's very hard to purely and fully advocate for DEI. Anything, because again, the central foundation of these programs was in response to this history of exclusion.
Janae Nelson heads the Legal Defense Fund, an organization founded by but long separated from the NAACP. She says the civil rights movement was and is about repairing the past. But she says diversity, equity, inclusion, and accessibility are not just remedies. They are beliefs.
You would be banning a viewpoint. You would be banning an idea, which violates the First Amendment off the bat.
She says you can't ban her belief that the world is better when it's more diverse, when people have equal opportunities. But she says that's exactly what the Trump administration and the activists that influence it are trying to do. Sandhya Dirks, NPR News.
Yesterday marked the LA Marathon. It also marked a celebration for a city still recovering from wildfires. Elise Hugh has the story of one fire victim who used marathon training to heal.
They say that tackling the marathon distance of 26.2 miles is a mental test more than anything else.
Oh yeah, one more step, just one more step. And afterwards, just one another step. So that's my motivation.
But training matters too. 15-year-old Abel Rivera has trained with his running club from Pasadena's Blair High School for 9 months. He expected the run, starting from LA's Dodger Stadium and winding through downtown, past City Hall, Hollywood landmarks, and down Beverly Hills' Rodeo Drive, to be painful.
I think the first 10 miles, I'll probably be all right. And then from mile like 11 to 12, I'll be struggling. No, I'll say 20 to 24, I'll probably be hurting a lot.
But running is the kind of pain he chooses. On January 7th, when the deadly Eaton fire tore through his Altadena neighborhood and burned down his home, that kind of pain is something he never chose.
I lost the house and like not really the way I wanted to. I didn't really want to leave it behind that way.
He lost other things too, including the medal he earned last year, the first time he ran the LA Marathon. Many of Abel's classmates also lost their homes in the fires. Eric Glenn coaches the running team and said they had to pause training in January.
The smoke was just too much. You can't run in the smoke.
But they got back on track and 19 students entered the race.
I don't know, like it just feels like we're doing it for our city, you know?
Abel started his marathon run just past 7 in the morning and ran side by side with his mother for the first half. By 1:30 in the afternoon, after about 6 hours of running, Abel Rivera,
welcome to your finish line,
crossed the finish line to earn his second LA Marathon finisher medal.
It feels like a milestone, and running the marathon is nostalgic. It reminds me of times before I had the fire.
His mom, Lupe Melchor, finished about 50 minutes later.
We didn't finish together, but we did it.
Glenn waited for all his students at the race's end.
And they just did a hard thing while going through a hard thing, you know, and it's really a testament to their resilience, and it's super inspirational.
Cleanup and rebuilding is only getting started in Los Angeles. Abel and his mother are still without a permanent home, but they aren't without hope.
I feel really good about myself that no matter what, I always push through.
A reminder of resilience and the capacity to keep going, even when it really hurts. For NPR News, I'm Elise Hugh in Los Angeles.
This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Progressive Insurance. Progressive is looking for individuals in a variety of career fields who want to help build a culture of inclusiveness. More information, including application, at progressive.com/careers. From the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, dedicated to improving the learning experience for America's students by sharing what works in pre-K through 12 education at edutopia.org. From Dignity Memorial, helping families today to protect their loved ones tomorrow. Planning celebrations of life in advance can give families peace of mind. Learn more at dignitymemorial.com.